This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Paul Lerner, coming to you from the University of Southern California. And it's my great pleasure to introduce today's guest, Carrie Wallach, Associate Professor and Chair of German Studies at Gettysburg College. Professor Wallach earned her PhD in German at the University of Pennsylvania in 2011. And in that same year, she started teaching at Gettysburg. She's the author of the acclaimed Passing Illusions, Jewish Visibility in Weimar Germany, which was published by the University of Michigan Press in 2017. And she co-edited the volume German Jewish Studies Next Generations, which appeared with Berghahn in 2023. Her many articles cover such topics as visual and consumer culture, gender and sexuality, film, and Jewish literature. Her new book, the subject of today's discussion, is Traces of a Jewish Artist, The Lost Life and World of Rachel Shelet. It was published this year by Penn State University Press. It's a beautiful, elegant, and painstakingly researched act of recovery of an extraordinary artist who has sunk into obscurity, whose life and work Carrie brilliantly sets into multiple historical and cultural contexts, from migration westward through deportation back to the East. Welcome, Carrie. I'm delighted to be speaking with you today.
Thank you so much, Paul. I'm so glad to be here with you.
So why don't we start by giving you the opportunity to tell listeners a little bit about yourself, about your path to becoming a scholar of German and Jewish studies, your intellectual trajectory, and how this book came about and how the topics that you've been researching over your career have come to you.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks for the question. So I'm someone who came to German a bit randomly. Maybe everyone has that story when they come to study a foreign language. We sort of fall into these things or they choose us. But when I was a high school student, I was an exchange student in Germany, and that was really where I got my language skills off the ground. And I became interested in Jewish topics and German Jewish topics as an undergraduate at Wesleyan University, and then decided, thanks to the guidance of my advisor, Noah Eisenberg, to pursue graduate work in German Jewish studies, specifically at the University of Pennsylvania. And that work, I went there knowing that I wanted to work in both German and Jewish studies, and that German would give me the ability to do that. But I think trying to understand me as a scholar means understanding that I have always already been sort of interdisciplinary in my approach. And I think about literature and culture in historical contexts, and I like to use foreign languages to access that literature and culture. So in some ways, it's similar to being like a cultural historian, but with less of the formal constraints of being a historian. Foreign languages have always been integral to what I do. And learning German at a young age was really important to my trajectory. I also studied a little bit of French and Yiddish and Hebrew, which all come together for this project as well. Here I am as a professor of German and Jewish studies, and it just happened that way for me.
So that's great. And that I want to find out more about how the project came together. But what strikes me already from what you've presented is that something that comes through in the book is language and your subject's existence in a world of multiple languages and her kind of moving through. I think I really like that you call attention to things that other scholars tend to gloss over, that, for example, she would converse in she meets someone of a similar background and they converse in Yiddish, or she speaks German, but not as a native speaker. So it can be a bit of a struggle or something she's self-conscious about. And this attention to the different languages, the overlapping languages I think it really makes your book, it gives your book a richness that I often miss in literature of the period. So were you thinking about language that way when you wrote the book, or is this just something that happened to occur?
Well, this project really is about trying to understand this artist whose life I've recovered, trying to understand Rachel Shalit and trying to think about all the different ways in which she was interacting with the world. And language is absolutely a big component of that with her because she has so many different places that she lives, so many different languages in which she engaged with the world. And I was always thinking about what is her strongest language, what language is going to be the one that's going to come out when she's in dialogue with different people. And it just so happens, I really do believe, certainly during the time she lived in Germany, that German was her strongest language and she would have been using it most of the time with native German speakers. And that's sort of what I'm getting from her ability to express herself in German in writing, in the writings that we do have, the limited ones. She wrote also elsewhere that Polish was a language she used not as well as other languages. So I know that she spoke Polish and maybe used it with her family. Although, you know, to be honest, I'm not sure if she used Yiddish with her family or Polish. And it's a really, these are the questions I can't answer. There's so many of those as well. But just thinking about the way that her mother tongue of Yiddish would have inflected the way that she understood and interpreted German, the way that she spoke and expressed herself, hearing those little tiny mistakes in her letters that sort of sound to me almost like an accent reminds us that she's not a native speaker of German. I don't know how well she spoke French. I don't have sources in French that she wrote, but I do know that she spoke it. So there's quite a few languages on the table that she knew. And all the time I'm thinking about her and her work and how she was using language, also text in conjunction with the images that she created, and thinking about why she chose each language and which words she chose. And yeah, language is a big part of the project.
I'm tempted to push on this further, but I do want to back up a little bit and give you a chance to tell listeners how she came to you and what the origin story of this book is. And I also want to ask about the process, because it's just amazing to me how you... Well, why don't we start there and then we'll come back and I'll ask you more specific questions about how you worked, how the working process was. So how did you first hear about her and what drew you in?
Yes. So when I was thinking about a dissertation project and doing reading around for my dissertation back in 2008, I was spending the year working in Berlin archives, a lot of time actually in the Jewish Museum Berlin, looking at newspapers on microfilm, some of which have since been digitized. But that archival work led me to, I was reading the German Jewish press from the 1920s, looking at Jewish periodicals. And I just increasingly kept sort of seeing her name come up here and come up there. And I was taking note of a lot of things. I was making a lot of indexes at the time. So I was writing it down and I was writing it down again and again. And maybe it's just that her name jumped out at me. It's a little bit unusual. And distinctive, and Shalit, it's clearly, and we can talk about this more too, but it's clearly not a sort of German spelling. So she really intrigued me and I became interested in her, and I, you know, did my Googling and who is this person? Who is this artist? Why haven't I heard of her? And there wasn't much to find. And that was where the project really kind of took root, was if there isn't anything about her, why? And how can I find more about her, and who can write more about her? At that time, there wasn't even a single scholarly article written about her, although one did come out in 2012 by Sabina Kohler that looked at just one of her works. But for me, I decided that at some point, I really wanted to tell her story. I had found enough material in the beginning. I knew I had enough material, at least for an article. And then the question was, did I have more material than that? Could I find more if I really spent time looking and investigating? And it went from sort of collecting all of the different references to her in the press that I could find through that research project and just sort of saving them over the years and going down this rabbit hole and that one, trying to just sort of track down any more information that I could find, to thinking about the project a little more methodically and trying to use a more sort of concrete research approach in doing this research. And that really started when I was looking to a sabbatical where I knew I would spend the year researching and writing this project. And that involved thinking, really kind of thinking creatively about how to find any information that could be out there in the world. So that involved thinking about
who did she know? Whose names have I ever seen written in conjunction with hers? Let's research them. Let's go to their memoirs and their papers, and let's find, see if I can just find anything else that will give me any other leads. Let's, you know, consult different databases and newspapers and anything that's become searchable over the years, any kind of references to her that are here or there. And all of that has led me really down very interesting paths to end up ultimately collecting sources from over 35 different archives that referenced her, or in some cases, you know, the absence of her is also a telling piece of information. But it all comes together to tell a story in the book. Yeah.
And one of the things that I find so moving and so compelling about your book is the detective work, but not just the detective work, but the kind of the sense, I mean, it's literally in the title, traces of that, you know, you're calling attention to your process and this figure, a really extraordinary artist. I wish we could show some of the images from the book to our listeners, but of course they can get the book and look themselves. Who, as you just alluded to, she was in conversation with many very well-known figures who are quite extensively documented, like Thomas Mann, like Käthe Kollwitz, like I was really excited to see Magnus Hirschfeld come up in this chapter, right? And these are Brecht and, you know, so many very well-documented figures, and yet she kind of lapsed into obscurity. So I think in reading your book, it makes me think not only of the subject itself, but of the process, where what do we remember from the past and what disappears, and how do certain people, certain subjects from historical, long gone historical eras, what gives some staying power and others not? So I think, you know, you've made such a contribution to how, you know, we think about this period and the different worlds that she went in and out of. Can you talk a little bit more about kind of, I mean, you over 35 archives, you said at the beginning that you're not a historian, but I think you've really earned your I don't think anybody could quibble if you wanted to claim that designation, because this is really very deeply historically researched and rigorous. Tell us a little bit about some of the surprising things you found in those archives, or places you didn't expect to end up, but your research took you.
Thanks, Paul. Yeah, for me, this is, and I guess I just wanted to touch on one of the other things you commented on before I sort of go into the archival finds. For me, the fact that this extraordinary artist fell into obscurity has to do with so many factors that we can also sort of comment on here. And I think because she lived between countries, between languages, there's just this lack of any one country stepping up to sort of claim her for their own art history and art historical records. And so that's something I think that has led to her being neglected and falling into obscurity. I also think, you know, several of the figures you mentioned who are so well documented, of course, are men and male artists, especially Jewish male artists. I think we're much more likely to make it into the art history books and history books in general. So I do think her gender has something to do with the fact that people have neglected to remember her and preserve her memory and place in history. But of course, also it's worth mentioning that she was murdered in the Holocaust, and much of her work was destroyed when her studio was plundered, when she was arrested in 1942. And just the fact that most of her paintings went missing is sort of another reason why we don't have more about her, and that just people can't go see her work in any museum because there's only a few paintings floating around. And a few years ago, there was only one painting floating around. So that's even fewer. So she's in the hierarchy of artists, you know, she's as an illustrator or someone who first became known as for her illustration work. She may not sort of rise to the top naturally in that way as well. So she's up against a bunch of different factors in terms of why she's been forgotten. But in terms of talking about some archival finds that I think are really, really worth mentioning, there are several different archives that have some letters of hers. And those letters, of course, are every single letter is worth its weight in gold, right? It really tells So every single word of the letter gives us a hint or a clue. And any name that's mentioned can open up so many doors. There's one letter that I translate in the book that she wrote to the theater critic Herbert Ehring, that tells us that Shalit was friends with, for example, artist Karl Hofer and a member of his sort of circle. And that was a really helpful letter from the Akademie der Künste. That archive has one of the few sort of Shalit collections that's a little bit more extensive, because Shalit was a member of the Association for Women Artists in Berlin, the Verein der Berliner Künstlerinnen. And that that file is particularly rich. I was also excited when I was reading her correspondence with the art historian Hans Hildebrandt, just to see that she did have these far-reaching connections to other Russian women artists, and she was naming them. It was unclear to me how well she knew them, people like Zineta Serebryakova, and other important, well-known women artists from the Russian Empire. So just thinking about some of those connections and her access to them, probably the, well, I'll say one more and then I'll get to the really exciting one. Pretty late in my research, I was able to access some materials that were in the archive at YIVO by, that they relate to the art historian Jacques Bielinki, a French, originally from the Russian Empire also, I believe, but living in France in the 1930s and into the 40s, art critic and art historian who, a journalist, who's actually become well-known because of the diary he left behind. But he wrote some articles about Shalit, and he sort of offered some really important insights into how she fit into the Paris art scene in the 1930s. And that was kind of a late revelation for me to be able to access those materials and hear him commenting on her work from his perspective. So that was really exciting. But I also, it's also worth noting that one of the reasons that was a later find is because I was doing a lot of this research during the pandemic. And so a lot of my archival sources came over email, and some archives had simply just shut down. So it took them a little longer to get back into the office and find materials. The one most magical find in terms of archival finds is one of the very few personal letters that we have that Shalit wrote to her friend Eleonora Kalkowska in 1934 in Paris. Most of the other correspondence that we have is professional correspondence. And this personal letter that she wrote existed in the archives of Kalkowska, the personal sort of family archives of Kalkowska. And it was held by her grandson, who lives in Poland, and was only found because somebody was writing a biography of Eleonora Kalkowska, a Polish scholar, reading in Polish, reading in Warsaw, right? Looking at these archives, these personal family archives that are not available to the public. And then because she wrote about Shalit and referenced Shalit in a couple of different articles, this is Anna Jabagina who wrote this, and she referenced a couple times Shalit in something that I was able to access online and find. It was then that I knew that I could contact her and reach out and get access to images of this letter. And that letter tells lots of different stories, including gives insight into the fact that Shalit had relationships with both men and women in her life. And therefore, we can sort of read her as a bisexual or queer figure. Really confirms that. And without that letter, we wouldn't have had the ability to sort of contextualize her so specifically. And it also tells us about the moment of living in Paris in 1934, where Shalit is thinking, should I go back to Poland? I've already fled to Paris. Would Poland be better? She was writing to her sister in Poland and having contact with her family still in Poland in 1934. And the answer was, Poland's not any better than Paris at this moment, even though Paris feels challenging and hard as a place to begin again in exile. It was still where she chose to remain until the end of her life. Yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda. Whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch, find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
It's The question I'm going to ask next, I think, is one that you're probably you get asked a lot, but it flows, I think, organically from this discussion of the archives and what you found, but what you also weren't able to find, right? And you alluded a minute ago to how much of her work was lost to us because of the Holocaust and other factors, and how much has sort of fallen between the cracks. And even in the book, you note that maybe one consequence of this book is that people will find more of her work, or it, you know, be aware, be on the lookout for it. And I think, you know, what's really striking is, on the one side, how much you've unearthed and recovered and brought to light, but also how much we just will probably never know, and how much is lost to us of her work and her life. And one approach you take to that in the book is to kind of imagine what could have happened in some situations. And it's, I think, a very bold move, and a move that many scholars would not be ready to take. But I was hoping you could talk a little bit about why you decided to do that. And I'll just fill the reader in a little bit more in case people have, or the listener, in case people haven't had a chance to read the book, that in the, there are italicized sections at the beginnings of the chapters where we're taken into conversations that could have happened, could have taken place, or, but they're really coming from, I would say, an imaginative reconstruction of how things could have been, who could have been in certain conversations or at art openings or at cafes. And Carrie, could you just talk a little bit about why you decided to do that and how that worked out?
Yes, these sort of fictional scenes that I call them are kind of a key to understanding what I'm hoping to do with this project in terms of bringing Shelley to life and recreating her for someone who's trying to understand who she was as a person, you know, writing the biography of someone who didn't leave behind a memoir or a diary, and who's really, we only have about, you know, a couple handfuls, maybe 10 letters, something like that. So we're not working with a tremendous amount of material. What's not there, what's been lost, is so much greater than what we have, which isn't normally the process, I think, that most historians work from, right? We go to the archive, we see what stories we could tell from the archive. That's a more normal process. But to say, I want to tell a story, but I don't have the archival material, is another approach. And for me, I found myself wanting to write the kind of narration that I would read in a work of either creative nonfiction, or at least in some cases, maybe even historical fiction. I was really inspired by Julie Oranger's The Flight Portfolio, for example, thinking about how she recreated the world of Marseille, 1940-41, and sort of brought Chagall to life. And that was made into a Netflix series called Transatlantic, right, that got a lot of attention later. But reading that book really helped take me into a place where I was thinking, okay, if I could really imagine Shelley in these places at this time, it would help me understand her. It would help me know what she was trying to do as a person, what she was able to accomplish, the challenges she faced. And I guess I'm a reader. I'm someone who likes to read fiction and novels and historical fiction. And all of those stories, I think, that I've been reading my whole life have really helped me think about how to tell stories. And in the case of Shalit, how to tell her biography, how to tell her story. I think there's something useful about being transported to a place and a time and a moment and a day in her life, and thinking, what was that day like? Who did she see? What did she experience? Where did she go that day? Who were the figures she was interacting with? And in many cases, really, I think in all of the fictional scenes that I wrote, they're all things that really are quite plausible, right? Not just possible, but like, they're people she, where I have evidence that she knew these people in general. And, you know, if it's an exhibition opening for an exhibition that she participated in, I assume she was there. I assume she went to at least the exhibition at some point, if it was an exhibition of her work. So it's not such a radical assumption to make, but she didn't leave us a story about what it was like to go to that exhibition or be part of that or see her own work exhibited. She didn't leave us behind a record. So I'm taking a little bit of an imaginative leap to say, what did it feel like on that day to be in that place? And The scene that opens the introduction, for example, she's at a birthday party for Ludwig Meidner. And I know she did attend that particular birthday party in 1923. And I know from files in his archives that Marc Chagall was also there, other figures who she was most certainly aware of and engaging with or in conversation with in her own work. So that sort of just offers clues into how she fits into the broader milieu. And in order to put the attention on her, put the center on her, to give her sort of a voice that she doesn't have, instead of telling the story from Meidner's perspective, which the archival records would allow us to do, right? Where Shalit is literally sometimes a marginal figure. You know, Shalit was there too, sort of scribbled in the margins of his notes. That's different than saying, what was her experience of that event? Like, well, who did she talk to? What language was she speaking? What was the conversation about? And how did that advance her career or relate to her career or who she was as a person? So, yeah,
it really, I just wanted to emphasize something you said in your response, that the kind of like what it felt like to be there or something, it comes, even though it is a kind of imaginative reconstruction or fictional section, it fictional scene, I guess is what you called it. It gives, there's a vividness, kind of sense. It works on a sensory level that I think a standard historical narrative often completely misses. And even if maybe some of the details aren't, they'll never be verifiable. And that's not the point, right? The point is that you're, and I just found that so exciting and so such a challenge to kind of think through and think with. So another question I have is, I'm sure one that you get asked a lot, but since the book is called Traces of a Jewish Artist, and one thing we haven't emphasized so much yet in our discussion is this work is a contribution to Jewish studies, Jewish history, Jewish art history. So I found this, that you're calling her a Jewish artist, to be really interesting, and clearly she is that, but I'm wondering what that means to you and kind of how, if you want to reflect a little bit about your choice to put, to use that formulation in the title.
Thanks, Paul. I have a couple of things to say about this. And one is, here is where I actually am trying to integrate Shalit's own voice into a description of who she was and her sort of foremost aspects of identity. She did write one, you know, two or three page autobiographical essay in 1930 in the journal associated with the Jüdische Frauenbund. And that essay is called Ich bin eine jüdische Künstlerin. I am a Jewish artist, using the female form for artist. And so she sort of declares herself in that piece of writing as a Jewish artist. And she's not calling herself a Polish artist. She's not calling herself a German artist. She's not picking a national affiliation, which I think is very telling and also helps us understand how she sort of saw herself in this transnational sense across borders her whole life. It didn't matter where she was always a Jewish artist in her mind. And she gets into more detail when one reads this account and others by her, where she does talk about her Lithuanian homeland and her sort of connections to East European Jewry. So we do hear sort of other references to more specific locations, and her background, but that for her, I think, represents a past, whereas the Jewishness represents past, present, future. It's sort of what goes with her, what she takes with her as an identity, no matter what country she's living in. And the other archival source that I can mention here to sort of back up my choice to call her a Jewish artist, is one that came to me a little later in a survey, I believe also in 1930, that she responded to. It was a survey of Jewish artists. She answered the question, sort of, what is your relationship to Jewishness, or how do you see yourself in terms of Jewish, being a Jewish artist? She really answered it in using the term Ostjuden, ich bin eine Ostjuden, right? And she really explained that she feels closest to East European Jews, and she really self-identified again as this East European Jewish woman. And not, you know, she really destigmatizes the term, whatever kind of pejorative undertones it might have in German don't exist for her understanding of it. She thought of herself as as a Jewish artist and an Eastern Jewish artist, to sort of use a better term than Ostjuda. That I think brings me to why I used Jewish artists, but I think there's also something interesting about the fact that we don't have the female form for when we're using the word artist in English. There's no way to gender the term. And so when we hear Jewish artist, our default setting, I think, is to automatically think of male Jewish artists. Take a survey of 100 people you know, and 99 out of 100 of them will come up with a male artist first if you ask them to name one Jewish artist, right?
Probably Chagall, so, above all.
Probably Chagall, right? So there's like an intervention, I think, happening with the title as well. I want people to say, oh, traces of a Jewish artist, but maybe if they're seeing the cover of the book or if they're reading the subtitle of the book and they're thinking, oh, a Jewish artist named Rachel, named, you know, a variation of Rachel. That's not what I was expecting. So there is meant to be some kind of maybe a slightly a little bit cheeky intervention happening here into sort of let's explode what people think when they think of a Jewish artist. It's perhaps a bit different than the common narrative.
That explains a lot. That's very helpful. And I mean, I think in this, there are often questions we've discussed many times in the past about when you consider an individual or a cultural product Jewish or not Jewish or German or what have you. And I think in this case, a good deal of a fairly high percentage of her artistic output is dealing with Jewish themes, explicitly either these Eastern European scenes or biblical scenes, as you get into a bit later in the book, or illustrations for Jewish works. And so she's clearly a Jewish artist in multiple ways, right?
Yes, and that's really the first thing that I say when I'm talking about her to people who are not familiar with her at all, is that she was both a Jewish artist in terms of identity and background, and she also created many different artworks with Jewish subjects. And that's, I think, important to emphasize, and also why we don't need to hesitate about calling her a Jewish artist or including her in a canon of sort of Jewish art history, because so many of her scenes relate to works of Jewish fiction, they're illustrations of Jewish fiction, or she also was, in some cases, even she wrote a couple of her own stories about Jewish holidays and illustrated them, right? So she's really engaging with Jewish subjects in a lot of different ways.
Absolutely. And so I wanted to also turn to get back into a topic that has come up a little bit in passing, but I know is really central to the book and to how you're thinking about your subject. And that is gender and sexuality and queerness as a perspective into her and her world, because you noted before that she had relationships with both men and women. She was married to a man fairly briefly. But I think she, independent of her own sexual choices, she's kind of moving in a world where kind of beyond binaries, where there's fluidity in all kinds of ways. And I was hoping you could tell us a little bit about how you approach those questions and how queerness kind of informed your work on Shalit and kind of your thinking about this milieu that she, or the different milieus that she worked in.
That's a wonderful question, Paul. Thinking about it from the perspective of how she fits also into queer studies, for example, or into these worlds, this queer history that we're always trying to tell and reconstruct from absences in the archival record. It's easy to understand where she was coming from if we think about the broader context of Weimar Germany, especially Weimar Berlin and 1930s Paris, these very open, sort of gender fluid, sexually fluid spaces where so many people were experimenting with gender and sexuality in their own lives. So it's not as if she's existing in a vacuum. She's really in a culture where this was, I don't know about standard practice, but certainly not an aberration, certainly a norm in certain ways. But I think she also had to find her way to those contexts. And early in her life, I think she came from a more traditional world and was faced with sort of more traditional options. And it's not difficult to understand why she was in a marriage to a man early in her life, even if that's something that she saw as part of a broader sort of trajectory later on. And I also have spent a lot of time thinking about the people she knew, again, many of them through the Association for Women Artists in Berlin, and many of them are sort of known to be queer or live as openly bisexual or lesbian. And there were sort of enough of them in her inner circles that if she's having, you know, meals, encounters, conversations, they're exhibiting together, if they're in each other's lives in a real way, they're obviously having conversations or at least sort of making reference to each other's personal lives. And it makes sense. It sort of follows naturally that that was something that she was experimenting with and in those circles also. Sort of seems like it was almost more common to be experimenting than not, or at least when one considers a broader subset of those artists. So I think the context is really important to understanding that. I will say that, especially you mentioned earlier, Magnus Hirschfeld, for example, that's where we start to have some really interesting evidence that she was professionally engaging with queer circles. This was another sort of later archival find for me, where I realized that Shalit had illustrated Thomas Mann's story, Dina, that later became part of his work, Joseph and His Brothers. And perhaps it was the earliest or one of the earlier publications of this story independently in 1929 in a magazine called Die Aufklärung, The Enlightenment, co-edited by Magnus Hirschfeld. And when the Magnus Hirschfeld archive provided me with these images and this story, I was really blown away by the fact that no one had really been looking at them or talking about them for almost for about 90 years, and that they were sort of one of these lost finds that needed to come to the surface. But the publication context of those images alone, and the fact that Shalit might have known or had a chance to meet or encounter Magnus Hirschfeld, certainly through name, if not in person, really opens doors to thinking about how she was actively choosing to sort of engage beyond traditional Jewish circles, but also be part of the queer life and the study of sexuality that Hirschfeld sort of initiated through his institute, and thinking about how she might have chosen to make that part of her project in a way. And the images themselves, the illustrations where she chooses to illustrate Dina and give her sort of a louder voice and emphasize her role in the story, all sort of plays into my understanding of Shalit as someone who was emphasizing female characters, and you know, the story of Dina with Thomas Mann's title is also emphasizing Dina, but it's a story of Dina as subject, not necessarily as agent. And for Shalit to sort of make her a primary figure in the story and one who she chose to emphasize through her illustrations also shows how Shalit interpreted literature in her own way as an illustrator, and brought to light and underscored some of the moments in a story that a male author, a male illustrator might not have highlighted or emphasized. And I think that's where we can also start to see Shalit as someone who was a feminist artist and sort of bringing women's voices to light. And I use the phrase sort of, she was an augmenting illustrator, right? She was really sort of adding on to the story by using her illustrations to perhaps tell a different story or a variation on the story, and interpreting the literature in that way herself. So I do think to some extent projects might have chosen her, but she also might have had some input into which projects she chose. So, and that's where we can start to see, going back to her, how she emphasized and engaged with queerness, why she might have been more interested in participating in a project organized in those circles.
I'm so glad you brought that up. And I have to say that that was one of my very favorite sections of the book. And I just found it so exciting to see her working in this space, to see how she, as you just said, this kind of notion of augmented illustration that I guess I have to confess, I'd never really thought about book illustration as all the choices that are involved in what to illustrate, how to represent. And I think this is a place where we see her Jewishness, her feminism, her attitudes toward gender and sexuality, and her artistic interests kind of all coming together in this really profound way, in a world that is, you know, a very male world. And here she's kind of between the poles of Thomas Mann and Magnus Hirschfeld, a very male world, also a very gay world in a way, or a sort of subtly gay world in the case of Mann maybe. But and connected to Jewishness in interesting attenuated ways. But I just thought that section was incredibly exciting, and to have the illustrations reproduced there to kind of rethink the biblical story of Dina along with her, things come together just so powerfully in that part of the book. I wanted to ask you also about her fencing, because I think that's just such an interesting detail that it comes kind of, you drop a few clues early on in the book, and then later we get her painting of her, or her representation of herself fencing. You tell us that she taught fencing as one, or possibly taught fencing as one way of supporting herself. So I wondered if you could talk a little bit about fencing and its significance for Shalit's life and work and the worlds that she inhabited.
Thanks, Paul. Some people, especially people who somehow personally have a connection to fencing, get really excited about the fact that she was a fencer. I have no personal connection to fencing, but I'm very excited that Shalit saw herself as a fencer and made it a big part of her world. I do think that she, I think she probably learned how to fence in Berlin, if she hadn't learned it already prior to coming to Berlin in 1916. And I think she probably might have had access to fencing through like women's fencing academies. There were several of them, and fencing clubs. And it was an activity. It was her sport. It was her exercise. It was something that she sort of started out doing because it was fun and engaging for her. And then, as you mentioned, she it was one of the things that she gave lessons in order to pay her rent. She was always a kind of struggling artist who never had enough money from selling her artwork to make ends meet. And so she taught drawing and painting and also fencing. And that's a bit anecdotal. We have, you know, sources that tell us she taught fencing and enough sources that they sort of corroborate each other. And we think that she did. We know she certainly spent time fencing. And for me, actually, one of the most amazing images that be left behind, and here we just have a photograph of a painting as opposed to the painting itself, but it's just a tiny little photograph that appeared in Die Dame magazine in early 1930, and it's called the Fencer Self-Portrait. And that portrait is, to me, one of the most exciting stories that she tells through her art, because it's a story of herself, it's the story of her journey, but it's also this intervention into the genre of the woman as artist self-portrait, where we see women artists often holding a paintbrush and a palette, maybe standing at an easel, engaging with art as they depict themselves as an artist. And for Shalit, her sort of self-portrait that made it into a magazine anyway was as a fencer, and she's not holding a paintbrush, she's holding an épée sword, right? She's ready to rise and face her opponent and sort of face the challenges and assert herself in a way that looks certainly a little more aggressive than if she were holding a paintbrush, but powerful also. And I can offer one little quote here, actually. She wrote one article about fencing that was published in the Bauhaus magazine, Die Neue Linie, also in 1930. And in this article, she really talks about her passion for the sport and how she engaged with it in her free time. And she positions it as something to think about in terms of strategy and resourcefulness. She wrote, "It is as if one is obsessed. Again and again, one feels pulled into the fencing saal to stand there lurking like a panther cat in order to then open fire on an opponent quick as lightning and thwart all of his good intentions." And to me, that really helps me envision her as a fencer, sort of using strategy in her fencing and taking and extrapolating that strategy and that sort of resourcefulness into the rest of her life as well. She's a bit scrappy, right? She's trying to pull together an existence and a career and make her name known, but not coming from a place of great sort of financial support or backing, didn't necessarily have the patrons or donors in large number that a male artist might have had. And so she's really doing it for herself with a kind of persistence, yeah, and resilience.
So it's almost a metaphor or a kind of a way of encapsulating her approach to life. And I think my sense is, if I remember right from your discussion, that there's a little bit of playfulness too, in along with the kind of fierceness that goes with the fencer in her rendering.
Absolutely. And the playfulness and the humor of her work is one of the things that makes her also so fun to engage with. And I don't know, should we talk a little more about humor? What do you think?
Well, I want to, absolutely. Yeah. But the next question that I had planned, which we can use or not, is about animals, actually, because, and I think that does connect to humor on one level. But I love that you mention, you know, you call attention to her representation of animals many times in your discussion. And it just, there's been so much really interesting historical and cultural studies work about animals and humans and animals in the environment and kind of the way the presence of animals in human life and how that changes over time and across cultures. And here we have an artist who is really at the forefront of modernism in so many ways, but who's also paintings or rendering scenes, drawing scenes from her Eastern European, Lithuanian, and Polish origins, where bringing the chicken from the Kapora ritual back into prominence. And I just think there's something very, very funny, but also very tender about the way animals appear in her work. So please, you can talk about either of those issues or both or whatever. I don't want to put too much pressure on you.
Thanks, Paul. It's funny, animals aren't necessarily where I go when I think of the humor, but I do think that they're something I've been enjoying talking about and sharing with people when I talk about this project, partly because the chickens in particular really do recur in quite a number of the images that she drew and painted. And it is almost like a leitmotif of her work is like the chickens, there they are again. And partly in through the Kaporis ritual that you mentioned, that that's a ritualistic use of an engagement with animals and a personification of them, right? Thinking about their sort of feelings during the ritual. What is that chicken feeling while it's being twirled around someone's head?
While it's negotiating.
Exactly. How could this situation improve for me? But as a part of life, I think that's the other way that animals really were significant for her, and the way that she's highlighting them often and drawing our attention to the way that they exist often in the background, but sometimes in the foreground. For example, in the stories that she wrote about, she wrote two stories about Purim and Passover. And in the story she wrote about Passover, it's about a matzah baking female protagonist who's supporting her family. And you know, she's got eight mouths to feed, eight children running around who need to eat. And she's really looking to run a tight ship, make as many matzahs as possible. And during her matzah production time of the year, she has to negotiate with the mayor in order to be able to continue running her matzah baking business. He wants to shut her down, and she convinces him to let her keep making matzah. And there's a disruption to the matzah baking that happens when the drunk chickens are sort of running all around the house and scaring the matzah bakers. And they think, oh, a dibbuk must have gotten into the chickens. Oh, we need to really take action here in order to be able to continue baking matzah and not be so scared. And you see their sort of superstitious side coming out. But ultimately, they determine that the chickens have just gotten into some mead in the basement, and they're actually just a little bit drunk. But that's another sort of really great example of why animals, or how animals sort of intersect with Shalit's use of humor and also thinking about their role in daily life. But so much, I think, of what Shalit is trying to do with those images and stories and illustrations, the Kaporis image, right, it's an illustration of a short story by Sholem Aleichem. So much of what she's trying to do with her work in bringing sometimes other people's stories to life and sometimes her own is help readers or viewers see that there is something lighthearted and humorous about some of these struggles and dark times and difficult moments. And I think that that's really, she's engaging with this concept that is often associated with Sholem Aleichem, this sort of laughter through tears concept. And she really takes that term and uses it for herself as well. It's not something I'm ascribing to her. She's using that phrase herself. And talking about just the sort of
resilience that Jews, I think, and Eastern Jews in particular, but the Jewish people as a whole have had to have in order to get through long periods of history where they were combating different sort of forms of oppression. And for her, the humor brings something to even the most difficult of times. And that helps us sort of see that she's threading something optimistic throughout her work, even when she's depicting hardship or suffering or something more sort of grotesque seeming or absurd. There's another angle, there's another way to view it. And that she helps us see those moments, I think, is one of her great contributions as an artist.
Which is, I would say, all the more poignant given that she was a victim of the Holocaust, that we don't know, I guess, exactly what happened to her, but we know she died after being deported. And that, I think, gives I just have to repeat the word poignance. It gives so much poignance to the way she sort of coped with adversity through kind of humor and lightness and manipulating traditions and surviving in so many contexts until she no longer could.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's not a whole lot to say about that chapter of her life. And I don't want to make the conversation such a fun and exciting conversation so dark, but I think we do need to acknowledge that that's what happened to her. That was her fate. And I think you bring the reader into it in a way that is, you know, suitably and appropriately moving without being heavy-handed or excessive in any way. So that must have been a very difficult needle to thread for you.
It allowed me to think in greater depth about what happened to sort of different cohorts of people who were victims of the Holocaust. And I think the way I ended up telling the story, where I look at both Shalit's experiences and her sister's experiences, helped us also think through what it meant for those who didn't migrate westward earlier in their lives, what it meant for those who stayed in Poland, who stayed in Łódź and were interned in the Łódź ghetto for several years before facing death or deportation, and how that differs from the experience that Shalit had, who she was basically sort of laying low in Paris, as I understand it, during the occupation of Paris, and sort of thinking about ways of escape that never came to fruition for her. And she was arrested in the Valdiv roundup in 1942, sort of as it was her time to be arrested. It was the moment when they were rounding up East European Jews, including women. And that was when, you know, she had registered with the police and they had her name and they came to her house and she was there. And that's sort of how the end of her life played out. And she was interned at Drancy for about 5 weeks before being deported to Auschwitz. So all of those moments, and including the years sort of leading up to her arrest, must have also been quite difficult, really anticipating and looking for a way out and not finding one. But I do think it was very interesting for me to contrast that with the experiences of her sister, and just thinking about how Jews in Poland experienced the Holocaust quite differently. But two members of the same family, two sisters with the same origins, same background, but in different locations, ultimately had very similar fates that I also
same
found
ending,
really
I was
striking.
Gonna say, yeah.
Yeah. But different sort of years leading up to that. And yeah, I guess it teaches us about the different sort of far reaching aspects of the Holocaust, Nazi killing machines, and the ways in which there were few places to hide all the way from Poland to France.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Carrie, I don't want to take too much more of your time, but perhaps we could kind of wrap things up by hearing about some of new projects that you're working on, or any new directions that your research has been taking. And I know this book just came out, so it's I don't want to assume that you've had time to really get deep into a new project, but I'd love to hear what your thoughts are.
Well, I have two things that I'll say, and one will sort of wrap up the Shalit a little bit more as well. you mentioned in one of your questions earlier, and I wanted to come back to it. One thing that I do in the book is sort of allude to the fact that I'm hoping that by making Shalit a better known artist and a better known name, that more of her works will come to the surface. And that is something that I've been thinking about in the last year or so as well. A couple of her paintings resurfaced at French auctions. Some of her drawings were sold at auction last year, original drawings, not prints. The Zangwill illustrations sold at auction for $12,000 in New York. And that was just a, kind of a really big moment for Shalit, almost like a turning point, right? Wow. Where if her work is selling for large sums of money, that means there's interest suddenly in the art market. And so I'm hoping that by calling attention to her name, by writing a book, there is a book about her, one can learn more about her and read more about her. I'm hoping to sort of spark that interest that will then make those paintings sort of come out of the woodwork and appear at flea markets or wherever they're going to appear, in France, in Israel, in Germany, who knows, mm-hmm. wherever they might be hiding. If people know that the Shalit work, which is usually signed either Shalit or Shalit Marcos from if it's before 1923, people know that that work has value, I think it's much more likely to come to light and be part of the sort of art that's in circulation today and art that people are seeing and thinking about. So that's one thing in terms of having more of her work be accessible to a broader public that I'm hoping this book will do in terms of a contribution. In terms of a next project, you're absolutely correct that I'm not quite there yet, and I'm not really ready to talk in great depth about where I'm headed next. But what I can say is that I really took something away from the experience of writing the fictional scenes at the beginning of each of these chapters, and I'm thinking about how I can use that skill set and also sort of how I as a storyteller can function in working on a next project that tells stories and brings stories to light. So it's still the same idea of telling the stories of perhaps women artists, perhaps other women who were active in Germany, Jewish women who were active in Germany in the early part of the 20th century, but how their stories can reach broader publics. I think that's one of the things that I'm invested in and that I'm interested in doing in the next project. So we'll see where that takes me, and I don't know yet. But thanks for the question.
Okay, well, I'm excited to see where it does take you. So let me thank you again so much for your time. I can't tell you how satisfying and intellectually stimulating it has been to read this book, to discuss it with you, to have you here today. So, great thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Paul. And thank you for helping me bring Traces of a Jewish Artist to a broader public through the podcast. And it was really just a real pleasure to be talking about it with someone who knows the project so well and who I've known for a long time. And thank you so much.
Pleasure.